It's Tuesday, May 11th. The FDA just gave the green light to 20 million kids. How many of their parents are ready to roll? We start here. Days before the CDC has even considered expert opinions, the FDA clears kids as young as 12 to get vaccinated.
Clinical trials have shown us very, very safe.
So how soon until they can start getting their shots? Republican governors tell Washington, our workers don't need your unemployment checks.
We don't need to pay people to stay at home when employers are begging for workers.
We called up the governor of Arkansas to get an explanation. And rocket attacks in Israel are nothing new, but this almost never happens.
It's been many, many, many years since I've heard sirens in Jerusalem.
Our reporter on the ground in Jerusalem explains why tensions in the Middle East are rapidly escalating. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. The natural next step in the road to getting America vaccinated was getting younger people vaccinated, right? We knew that. And so for weeks, the plan has been get the results of some scientific trials, have a big hearing with doctors, and then watch the FDA and CDC likely approve vaccinations for kids between 12 and 15 years old.
Hello and welcome to this FDA virtual press conference today.
That big hearing is scheduled for tomorrow.
We learned just before we came on the air tonight that the FDA has just authorized the Pfizer vaccine for children now 12 to 15 years old.
But yesterday evening, in a surprise announcement, the FDA said, we're good to go now. Let's start the show with ABC's chief medical correspondent, Dr. Jennifer Ashton. Dr. Ashton, can you explain this announcement from the Food and Drug Administration?
Well, yeah, the FDA announced that the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine really met the criteria for them to make an amendment in their emergency use authorization in the 12 through 15-year-old age group. So their statement, basically what we want to hear in medicine and science, that the known and potential benefits of the COVID-19 vaccine outweigh any of the known and potential risks.
Hey, you've always said kids are not just like little adults, right? Like there are key developmental markers happening in a 12-year-old that are not necessarily happening in an 18-year-old or a 40-year-old. So is this vaccine safe? Is it expected to work the same way in a 12 or 13-year-old?
Well, you know, that's exactly why they did what's called bridging clinical trials. And you're 100% correct, Brad. I'm glad to hear you quote one of my favorite lines
in
medicine. That's right. Kids are not little adults.
To evaluate the safety of the vaccine, the FDA looked at a clinical trial of more than 2,000 adolescents aged 12 through 15 years of age.
So they did test the dose in this age group. They tested efficacy and they looked for side effects, and they saw no significant safety signals.
Side effects seen in adolescents ages 12 through 15 were similar to those experienced by individuals 16 and older.
And they saw excellent efficacy.
No cases of COVID-19 occurred among the 1,005 adolescents who received the vaccine, compared to 16 cases in 978 placebo recipients, thus indicating the vaccine was 100% effective in preventing COVID-19 in this trial.
It just so happens that in the 12 to 15-year-old population, they are using the same dose as they use for adults. But in their younger trials using younger children, they are testing lower doses as well.
Well, so then what's next, Dr. Ashton, on the administrative front, on the approval front, and just do parents just start getting ready to sign their kids up for vaccines like everyone else?
Well, a lot to unpack there, Brad. First of all, on Wednesday, the CDC will make their decision on this. We've heard the CDC director, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, say that she is hoping and expecting to see the FDA authorize, which they just did. So it is expected that the CDC will put its stamp of approval on this as well. And then, yes, parents can literally start signing their children up. And the hope is that as they go into the summer camp, summer school, whatever they want to be doing to normalize the summer of 2021, that they will have both doses of the Pfizer vaccine on board with good immune protection, which is not only important for their health, but to help protect those around them as well.
But will they? I guess is also the question that goes along with all this. If you got parents who did get themselves vaccinated, is it a given that they are going to also sign up their kids, or is that a whole different ballgame?
Yeah, there is some indication that there is some increasing hesitancy amongst parents for vaccinating their teens or their children. Basically comes out by thirds. A third of parents say they're willing to get it and they can't wait to sign their kids up.
My husband sent me the text and I started crying in the car. I'm like, oh my God, it's happening.
A third say they want to wait and see, and a third say they're hesitant.
I'd be very concerned about my daughter. I would not want her to. I'd want her to hold off.
I'm not comfortable with her taking it because to me, it has not been tested long enough.
I would just encourage parents to ask their healthcare providers about the vaccine.
And I think it's really important to remember that in medicine and public health, we have to make these decisions based on four important questions. What's the risk of getting the vaccine, which clinical trials have shown us very, very safe, very low risk? What's the risk of not getting the vaccine? Well, the risk of not getting the vaccine is not only for clinical disease for yourself, but passing it to someone else who could get seriously ill or even die. But it's also for the return to behaviors, schools, camps, activities that are so important.
In particular, you can go all the way to the entire high school and going down almost all the way to the middle school. So these are very, very good news.
So those are the four questions that parents and pediatricians are going to have to address. And I think if people do that, they'll be able to come to the right decision.
Yeah, and then questions whenever you're talking about kids, on do they just go to the same clinic that they're parented, or could this be available in more places? That's still up for debate, and the CDC is specifically going to be looking at kind of protocols, how they roll this out. Dr. Jennifer Ashton, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, the jobs numbers were bad, so why are some states using them as a reason to cut off unemployment? More after the break.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking at that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much I know.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.
We talked yesterday about how staggering this jobs report was late last week, not only because of the disappointing numbers, but because this completely throws a wrench in the White House game plan.
Direct cash payments, extended unemployment insurance, rent relief, food assistance, keeping essential frontline workers on the job, aid to small businesses. These are the key elements to the American Rescue Plan.
See, this whole spring, President Biden's checklist has been get Americans vaccinated, check, get COVID cases down, check, get the American economy back on track. And once that happens, he was thinking, my poll numbers will be good. Republicans will look silly for opposing my stimulus ideas. They'll almost be forced to work with me. Well, if we keep seeing jobs numbers like this, that last check mark is very much up for debate.
I never said, and no serious analyst ever suggested, that climbing out of the deep, deep hole our economy was in would be simple.
And in the last few days, several states, particularly red states, have taken this as vindication, and they're acting on it.
There are millions of jobs open, help wanted signs from coast to coast. We should not still be taxing the Americans who are working to fund continued extra benefits for those staying home.
During a once-in-a-lifetime pandemic, Washington, D.C. had told states, hey, in addition to your usual unemployment benefits that you give your citizens, people who have been laid off during this pandemic can get an extra benefit from the federal government.
Arkansas is set to become the first state in the Mid-South to end its participation in federal pandemic unemployment programs.
Well, now, states like South Carolina, Montana, and Arkansas are saying, thanks, but no thanks. Those unemployment benefits have actually been part of the problem.
In a letter sent Friday, Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson wrote, continuing these programs until the planned expiration date of September 4th is not necessary and actually interferes with the ability of employers to fill over 40,000 job vacancies in Arkansas.
We got the governor of Arkansas with us right now, Asa Hutchinson, Republican. He's in Little Rock. Thanks for being with us, Governor.
Hey, great to be with you. Thank you.
Now, I got to ask, as a governor, as a politician, somebody who people have to vote for, how do you make this pitch? How do you tell your constituents, hey, I know you guys have been hit really hard by this pandemic, but we're actually going to take away benefits for those of you who have lost jobs? Like, how are your constituents not going to see this as a punishment?
Well, the bottom line is that people of Arkansas want to work, and this gives them a greater opportunity to do it and an incentive to do it. We don't need to pay people to stay at home when employers are begging for workers. And that's what I hear. Mm-hmm. I don't hear really anything other than please help us to get our jobs filled that we need so desperately. And so, we will help them find a job. If they have a hard time locating a job because there's plenty out there, we'll make the connection. And if you need childcare, we'll make sure that it's available for essential workers and low-income individuals. And so we want them to work. They want to work. And this provides them make sure that they have all the incentives to do that by taking away that $300 per week extra payment.
Hey, now, people, the idea of people deciding not to work because, hey, they're getting probably better money than they would at the restaurant or minimum wage job, whatever. Is that a thing that's happening? Like, are there actual examples of people in Arkansas doing that? Or is that just kind of something you hear from business owners?
Well, part of it is human nature. And I don't want to be too difficult on individuals because they might have not have a job for good reasons. And they might have the comfort of being at home and helping their children. So I don't want to be harsh on them. But the fact is, whenever you're given the extra supplemental payment to them, they can make just as much money at home versus a job that's paying $15 to $18. And so that's not working very well. And for all those people that are working, it's a discouraging factor to them, and it's pulling our economy down. So, yes, whether it is in the hospitality industry, they need workers, whether it's manufacturing, just every industry, and it's all across the state. You can look at the Delta regions of Arkansas that are low, high poverty areas, and they're needing workers. And I hear the same thing from them. This is broadly supported by our legislature as well. And so,
but that's kind of my point is I hear you saying there are business owners that need workers. I'm asking, do you guys have examples of people who have turned down work because they're not, or is that just you're looking at the math and adding up the math numbers and going, oh, well, obviously there must not be people must be turning down work here.
No, I mean, it's very much anecdotal, but without any doubt, you have employers that have told me that they will sign up for an appointment to be interviewed so they can fulfill their claim for unemployment. And then they don't show up for the interview. They also tell me that whenever the $300 supplemental went away at one point, all of a sudden the job applications increased. And then whenever it was reinstituted, the job applications went down. Mm. So there is a causal effect that the employers see tied to this.
But from the worker's perspective, like, that's illegal for the worker to do. Like, I'm looking at your state website right now, right? It says to keep collecting unemployment benefits, you must be able to work, available to work, and looking for unemployment. If you're offered a suitable position, you must accept it. That's the law. So is the rationale for, I mean, is this an admission that Arkansas is somehow not capable of enforcing this law on its workers?
Well, it's difficult to enforce, first of all, and we have to have employers that will call up and say so-and-so didn't show up. And so those are very large logistic challenges to be able to enforce that. And again, it's human nature. I mean, Arkansas workers are probably more aggressive and willing to work than all across this country. But it's human nature that whenever you're challenged in life, just stay at home. You can make as much money, and it's a disincentive. We don't need disincentives in this economy. And, you know, and some people, like I said, is in childcare, you know, that is important to them, but that is available. And we want to make sure they have access to that.
Right. And I was going to say, so President Biden and Democrats have essentially said, this is more of an issue of, you know, say you're a restaurant worker, your kid's daycare went out of business last year because no one was sending their kids to daycare. You're in a state with low vaccination rates. No one wants to wear masks in restaurants. And by the way, you saw a bunch of your colleagues get sick last year. So you're even more terrified of COVID than the average American. Like those things are holding a lot of Americans back from going back to work. So what do you, I guess I'm wondering, what do you say to that? And what do you say to Democrats who say, that's why you got to pass bigger, bolder, more generous plans?
Well, I would say a couple of things. First of all, I checked today, and we have over 1,900 child care facilities that are open in Arkansas, and that is only 12 less than we had pre-pandemic. So we have plenty of facilities that are out there. Secondly, we still have $16 million left in child care coverage from the original CARES Act. That does not count the $178 million that we received in Arkansas for child care support. We got that in December. And we have not even yet received the additional money that's going to come in for the American Rescue Plan. And so childcare is not a reason not to go to work. We have the funds available that applies to essential workers as well as low-income individuals.
All right, Governor Asa Hutchinson there in Arkansas. Thanks so much.
Hey, great to be with you. Thank you.
There are certain parts of the Middle East that seem to be constantly under attack or under threat of attack. Like, take the areas around Israel. In the north, you got the Golan Heights right up next to Lebanon and Syria. Lots of action. In the south, there are tons of rocket attacks around the Gaza Strip, that little stretch of Palestinian land right next to Egypt. You hear about these tunnels giving access to whoever. One place that is hardly ever targeted, though, right in the middle of everything, is Jerusalem, the holy city for Muslims, for Christians, for Jews. Well, in the last 24 hours, that has changed, and the entire region is very unclear on where this could lead. Let's go to ABC's Jordana Miller, who's based in Jerusalem. And Jordana, that's the thing. You live there, right? So were you just all of a sudden sitting at home when rockets were coming into town? What happened?
Yeah, it was actually, you know, a really, for me, a very unnerving situation. You know, I'm a new mom. I have a seven-month-old newborn, and I was actually putting him to sleep when suddenly I heard a siren, and I thought, oh my gosh, I can't believe it, but Hamas is actually firing rockets towards Jerusalem. This is so unprecedented. It's been many, many, many years since I've heard sirens in Jerusalem. Mm. So my baby, I guess, could sense the tension, and he couldn't fall asleep. He started to cry. I grabbed him. I had to go running to try to find somewhere in my home, you know, that is a secure area where there is not a lot of glass. And I waited there patiently until I got word of what exactly was happening.
I have no idea where that was just now, but that was three very large booms. Four, right there. Right there in the sky, you can see it.
It's incredible, Brad, because in the span of 5 or 6 hours, we saw 150 rockets now fired on southern Israel.
We see this as a severe attack against Israel, an attack that will not go unanswered.
Israel has carried out reprisal airstrikes throughout the Gaza Strip, at least three rounds of them. Health officials in Gaza reporting at least 20 killed there. Some Hamas military leaders among the dead, which tells us that Israel appears to be carrying out some kind of targeted assassinations. The Prime Minister said that he thinks the rockets that fired on Jerusalem crossed a red line, that Israel will have a forceful response, and he even prepared Israelis, saying, you know, this is going to go on for, quote, some time.
Wow. So, okay. So different from usual then, right? Like we've seen rockets go into the southern parts of Israel before. We've seen rockets even go toward Tel Aviv. But what set this all in motion? If this red line got crossed,
How did we get here?
Well, it's taken a number of different events over the last month to get to this kind of explosive round of violence. It began in the beginning of Ramadan when Israel barricaded and blocked off a very popular spot for Muslims to gather over Ramadan. That sparked 2 weeks of protests and rocket fire until Israel removed those barricades. Then there has been a very, very controversial court eviction notice given to a number of Arab residents in a Jerusalem, in a neighborhood in East Jerusalem.
Deep inside, they know that this land is Arab-Palestinian, and the papers have been forged.
They may have to leave their homes after living there for decades because some Israeli Jews are claiming the buildings belonged to Jews before the establishment of the State of Israel.
This is our houses, but they want to control it. This is the Jewish country.
Palestinians feel they're being pushed out of East Jerusalem, which of course is what they want for their future capital. And then the Palestinian elections have been canceled. Israel was blamed for that. It likely has much more to do with the Palestinian president's fears that Hamas would win in that election. Nonetheless, Palestinians so angry about a number of issues that just exploding into this violence.
Police were in riot gear as they fired rubber bullets and stun grenades while Palestinians hurled stones at the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Over the weekend and including Monday, there have been over 500 Palestinians injured in clashes with the Israeli police.
Wow. So there's this sense then building throughout the weeks and over this weekend, like throughout the Arab world and throughout the Palestinian world, that they're getting the short end of the stick. Where does this go from here, Jordana? Because it's sort of uncertain times for, like you said, the Palestinian government, also the Israeli government. I got to imagine stuff gets dangerous when politicians feel like they got something to prove.
Absolutely. I've seen a lot of rounds of these kinds of cycles of violence. This one does feel different.
Hamas and other Palestinian terrorist organizations have fired dozens of rockets at Israeli civilians.
It feels that the Israelis are intent on really carrying out an intensive bombing campaign to really hit Hamas targets and tunnels. And part of that stems from the fact that there is a kind of political vacuum that Israel's operating in, right? Netanyahu lost the mandate. His opponents are trying to put together a government. That government will be sworn in likely in 2 weeks, and it needs to show that it has a strong hand starting out. On the other side, Hamas feels a bit reckless right now. They don't have that much to lose, and they're angry about the Palestinian elections being canceled because they were the ones that stood to gain the most from those elections. So it is a dangerous combination. I think we're at a volatile moment.
All sides need to de-escalate, reduce tensions, take practical steps to calm things down.
It's so unclear whether we're going to see, you know, an escalation that will last for days or if it'll just be a 24 or 48 hour cycle. That's, you know, always the unknowns in this region.
Right. When the folks who feel like they're being kept out of power are the same ones who have the rockets, and when the side with the military, like the actual army, is saying you've crossed a huge red line, we've got to respond, things escalate very quickly. That's what we're seeing right now. Jordana Miller in Jerusalem. Good luck. Thanks.
Thanks, Brad.
All right, we're going to take one more quick break. But when we come back, you know it's bad when Tom Cruise thinks you're toxic. War of the Globes in just a bit.
And the Golden Globe goes to...
And one last thing. Ratings for big Hollywood award shows have not been great this year in the COVID era. So why would you go to bat for the one that Hollywood truly can't stand?
Everybody is understandably upset at the HFPA and their choices. Look, a lot of flashy garbage got nominated, but that happens, okay? That's like their thing.
Yesterday, NBC announced it will not be airing next year's edition of the Golden Globes.
NBC airs the Golden Globes. They have the contract, so it's their show.
And that's ABC's entertainment correspondent Jason Nathanson.
And the reason that they made this decision, they say, is because the Golden Globes has been under fire for several months because of all sorts of different problems within the organization.
And you might remember, he actually broke some of this down for us a while back.
The people that vote on the Globes are the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, which has been accused of self-dealing. It's also got an astonishing lack of diversity.
They have no black members who vote on any of the Golden Globes of their 87 members, so that's a big problem.
Well, since we last reported on this, a series of dominoes has fallen.
Thank you, and we look forward to a more inclusive future.
Last week, the Hollywood Foreign Press had this big meeting where they vowed to make changes. The problem with that is it gives everyone else a chance to say, we're out.
They voted to make the changes. And first, Netflix was the big one that said, hey, look, we don't like the speed with which you're making these changes. That's good that you're making them, but it's not enough and it's not fast enough. So what we're going to do as Netflix is we have all these big juicy movies and TV shows. We're not going to give you access to our stars.
So Jason says during award season, this is how it works. Studios make their biggest stars available to the press. Usually these appearances are divided into 2 days. One day with American press and another day with foreign press, which is mainly these 87 voters.
So Netflix said, you know what? We don't like the way you're doing things. We're not going to give you this access. Then Amazon said, you know what? Yeah, same with us. And then Monday morning, Warner Media said, which is HBO, and you know, we're talking all the prestige projects here. Warner Media said, yeah, we're not going to give you access as well.
Like it just all of a sudden it got icky for these groups to shop, really to pursue the Hollywood Foreign Press. Like, we're not going to shop to you guys. You guys are gross.
Right. They didn't want to be associated with them. And then also over the weekend, you had some stars coming out, Scarlett Johansson probably being the biggest, saying that she's done these press conferences. And you know what? The members of the Hollywood Foreign Press Association have said some kind of racist and sexist things in some of their questions.
In fact, Jason said in his time as an entertainment reporter, sometimes he's been clamoring for access. He gets shoved in with the foreign press. And whether it's a language thing or a culture thing or actual bigotry, yeah, questions get weird.
Also, Tom Cruise said, you know what? I'm giving back my Golden Globes. He's won 3 over the course of his career.
Wait, giving them back, is it like he's FedExing them or something? Yeah. Does he have to get insurance on a package? What do you do?
I don't know if there is insurance involved, but yeah, that's pretty much it. He returned them. He said, here, this is yours. I don't want them anymore.
Now, all this raises the question, will the Golden Globes happen at all? Remember, the story here is not that they're dead. It's that NBC won't air them. The big question in Hollywood right now is whether the Hollywood Foreign Press is allowed contractually to seek other TV deals. And if they are, will anyone want them? I love Netflix being like, we're over the Golden Globes. When you could argue this all started because Netflix lobbied really hard for its show Emily in Paris, and they got what they lobbied for, a ton of awards. It sparked a lot of controversy. Start here tomorrow. Hit subscribe if you haven't already. More on all these stories at abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt cartridge.
What were you thinking at that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much up.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.